Episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast, a show where I speak to people who interest and inspire me from the wonderful world of education. Now, this is an episode from season 3 of my Research in Action mini-series, where I interview researchers from Loughborough University's Centre for Mathematical Cognition about their chosen areas of interest and, crucially, the implications for teachers in the classroom. And I try my very best, and always fail, to not come across completely out of my depth. Now, for season 3, we have 6 episodes, and my plan is to release one every week to take us through the summer holidays. So this week, we have Jodie Hunter. Jodie is a visiting professor at Loughborough University from Massey University in New Zealand. Now, we discuss developing culturally responsive mathematics education in classrooms with students from diverse ethnic groups, including Indigenous and migrant groups, through building on culture as a strength. And this is one of those that completely blew my mind. Now, as was the case last week when recording these episodes, I'd lost my voice. My wife was very happy about that. So apologies in advance for the croakiness, coughs, and occasional weird shifts in pitch. I think I squeak on several occasions. Enjoy. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Jodie Hunter to the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast. So hello, Jodie, how are you?
Good, thank you.
That's fantastic. Can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. So I'm from New Zealand, Cook Island, New Zealander. So that means my family comes from one of the small Pacific nations. I'm a professor in mathematics education. I have previously worked in the UK at the University of Plymouth in the early part of my career, and I was also a primary school teacher prior to that.
Amazing. Fantastic. Right, well, we like to start with math speed dating questions. So question number 1, what is your favourite number and why?
Number 4. I like even numbers, and I'm not really sure, but 4's always been the number that I liked. I think it's a little bit to do with square numbers and the pattern that it makes. Yeah. So
good one.
There you go.
Good choice. I'll tell you a little fact for you here, Jodie. The only other person who's chosen 4 is the famous memory and desirable difficulties researcher, Professor Elizabeth Bjork. So you're in strong company there with number 4. A good choice.
Wonderful.
Number 2, what was your favourite topic in maths as a student?
Algebra. So I've always liked patterns and looking at relationships. So that's always been my favourite area of mathematics.
Fantastic. And we may well return to algebra later in this conversation. So that's excellent news. And finally, what job would you like to do if you weren't involved in education and research?
The job I really wanted was to be a musical theatre Broadway star. But unfortunately, I'm not very good at singing. I can do the dancing, but not the singing. So,
oh, you're halfway there. That's good, though. That's good. That's fantastic. And the other question we like to ask before we dive into the research is just if you've got a favourite failure, something that didn't go according to plan in your research or your career, but you learned something important from it.
Yeah, so I think probably for me, it's from my primary teaching years and even when I've been teaching at the university. And I think every time, what really sparked my interest in mathematics education research were the moments in the classroom when I thought I'd taught something really well, and then a child would say something which showed they had a misconception or misunderstanding, and it would always make me think, oh, what happened there, you know? Where's the missing part? So I think those kind of experiences led me to want to understand more about how children learn mathematics and the kind of processes and how we can all become better educators of mathematics.
That's brilliant. Yeah, the gap between I taught it and they learned it is, yeah, potentially a huge and scary one. That's brilliant. Fantastic. Right, Jodie, well, tell listeners what we're going to be talking about today. What's your chosen area of research and why does it excite you?
So I worked with an early algebra. That was my first passion. I did my PhD in that. Again, I just have always been quite interested in algebra. Talking about those kind of failures, I came into this because I went to a conference, and at this conference I went to very early on when I was teaching, but also doing my master's, and somebody was doing a research presentation on the equal sign and children's misunderstanding of the equal sign and thinking that it was an operator. So in that session, I sat there, and I was teaching a year 5 and 6 class, and I sat there very confidently thinking, oh no, I'm going to do that when I get back to my classroom, and my children will definitely know how to do that. So I got back to my classroom, I put up some true and false number sentences with the children, and they all answered it incorrectly. So that, yeah, so I was very surprised and shocked by that, and it's kind of became a bit of a passion looking at early algebra. But I've more recently also interlinked that with this idea of culturally sustaining mathematics pedagogy. So for myself, as a Cook Island New Zealander, and for many children who come from diverse cultural backgrounds, I think often we don't see our own culture represented in the mathematics classroom. And that can lead to difficulties in developing a positive mathematical identity for learners who come from diverse cultures. So the work I've been doing is thinking about what are the growing patterns, or what are the kind of algebraic patterns that occur in Pacific culture. So we have a lot of dance, we have a lot of art or kind of cultural artifacts like weaving or quilt making. We do dance, which is in Samoa, for example, called sasa, which is like a slapping and clapping dance. It has a lot of patterns in it, so kind of like an embodied pattern, and it represents life. It's a story, really. It tells a story of your life in the Pacific. So you have different hand movements which represent flying fish or birds or things like that. Yeah. So the work is kind of blending together to think about how we can use patterns which come from children's own culture and use those in the classroom to develop the algebraic thinking. So it's really interweaving mathematics and this kind of indigenous knowledge or experiences of children.
That's amazing. Plus your interest in dance as well. It's all coming together nicely, this journey. I like it. Right. I have a number of questions on this. Sure. First, this isn't a question, just a reflection. Just that whole thing about the equal sign blows my mind, right? Like, it took me about 12 years of teaching to realize that students see equals, yeah, as you say, as an operation. And I was using it very haphazardly, sticking in equal mm-hmm. signs left, right, and center. And I try to be much more careful with my use of equal signs now. But yeah, it's a biggie, isn't it?
I think that's a really important point. It's always something I work at, doing a lot of professional development with teachers, and also always cognizant of saying to teachers, be aware that you don't use the equal sign in a big string, for example, or let the children do that. And also, I think a lot of teachers are unaware of the kind of misconception, and it's such a huge block for children to access algebra when they go on to secondary schooling.
It really is. It is as well. And I think I might have gone too far here, because I'm now obsessed with the kind of equality sign. So I'm using that all over the show now. So if I'm doing like equivalent fractions or whatever, I'm saying 4/6 is equivalent to 2/3. But then kids are like, what's that weird sign? So then I'm having to try and kind of teach that sign. And I'm just worried I've gone too far now, that all the attention's on this weird sign and it's taken away from the thinking about the kind of fractions. And I might as well just stick the equal sign in. But I'm trying to hold firm. Am I doing the right thing there, Jody, do you reckon?
Oh, I don't think there's anything wrong with exposing children to different representations in mathematics. Yeah. I actually think kids get really interested in that. Children get really interested in that. So, I mean, it's like I've been using unequal with young children, with 5 and 6-year-olds. Yeah, and some people will go, oh, why would you do that? You know, they're just very young children. But I think actually young children, it's fascinating for them. They want to, we're giving them the tools of mathematics. mathematics, and that's important.
Mm. All right, I'll stick with that. That's good to know. All right, second question, just to frame this. What do you mean by early algebra? Because I'm speaking here as kind of a secondary maths practitioner here. Are we talking about kind of the idea of kind of generalization as opposed to any kind of formal notation or anything like that? What do you mean by early algebra?
Yeah, so it is generalization. I think that we can start introducing formal notation with the understanding that children aren't necessarily going to have a full understanding of what a variable is, for example. But we can use kind of informal variables like shapes or even letters if the children are comfortable with that, because that gives us, again, a tool which is much easier to write a rule using notation than it is to verbalize it. So when we offer children those tools, it gives them more access to mathematics again.
I keep that in mind.
Yeah, sure. So I keep that in mind that I'd never argue that the children have a full understanding of what a variable is or what it means, but I think it can be used in a way that's not intimidating for children, and in a way that's positive, that gives them access to representing their mathematical thinking.
Got it. And what curriculum in particular are you studying, Jodie? And what age do students first encounter these concepts within early algebra?
Yeah, so I've worked right with five-year-olds. I tend to work with five-year-olds up to 12-year-olds. And the particular work that I may be able to talk a little bit about today was actually with 6- and 7-year-olds.
In the UK?
No, this was in New Zealand.
In New Zealand, so, got it.
Yeah, but I had actually worked, my PhD thesis was in the UK, and that was with a year 3 class in the UK, a year 2 class, a year 3 class, and a year 5 class. And with that, I worked with teachers looking at how you can integrate early algebra into their everyday mathematics teaching. So how you can kind of find the algebra that's sitting within your everyday mathematics.
Amazing. Love it. Love it. Now, just a couple of other reflections before we dive into your research. This idea, how you're integrating this with your interest in kind of cultural diversity and so on, I think is fascinating. The reason this is interesting is because a big cliche that often gets thrown around is that maths is the universal language, and it kind of, you know, goes across barriers and so on and so forth. So we don't need to worry too much about making it kind of, you know, adapting it for different cultures and so on and so forth. But would that be wrong, would it, Jodie, do you think?
I think there's mathematics in every culture. So that's where I think the universalness sits. But I think unless we help children see the mathematics in their own lives and in their own culture, then they don't see it. They don't recognize it. And I've done a lot of interviews with children asking them about their kind of cultural identity in the mathematics classroom. And this is in New Zealand, but I'm sure that you would have similar in the UK. And it's been really shocking and quite surprising for us in a negative way how many children will negatively talk about their own cultural background in regards to mathematics. So we have children who say, from the Pacific Islands, who say they'll say things when we ask them, we always ask a question, how do you feel being whatever culture you identify with in the classroom? And we'll get children who say things like, it's weird because I'm Tokelauan and Tokelauans don't do maths, or I'm Samoan and you have to become a palangi, which means like a white person, to do mathematics, and then at the end of maths I can go back to being Samoan. So, and this isn't the odd comment, this is a lot of children who say things like this. And we even have converse kind of comments, I suppose, from children who come from Asian backgrounds, from China or from Korea, who say negative things about being Chinese in the classroom as well, in terms of the kind of pressure that they feel under because of this whole notion that mathematics is, you know, you're automatically going to be good at mathematics. Yeah, it's a different, that's a different kind of area, but it's very interesting, you know, all this kind of, I'm Chinese and so everyone always looks at me because they think I'll have the right answer, and, you know, yeah, or if I don't have the right answer and I get something wrong, I feel like I'm not Chinese anymore. So yeah, so it's quite an interesting area anyway to look at.
Jeez, that is three things really. Firstly, that's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating. I'd never thought about that aspect of it, the kind of almost the positive cultural representations of it, in the sense that you're expected to be a good mathematician if your background is Chinese or whatever, but how that could, yeah, put undue pressure on students. That's really interesting, that. But going back to your kind of earlier point here, for the students who feel kind of culturally that they're going to struggle mathematically, that's a really interesting one. Would that be different? So they wouldn't say that about another subject, right? They wouldn't necessarily say, I'm going to be bad at geography because of this. It's math seems to have some hold over these students. Would that be fair?
Yes, I think that's definitely true. You know, we can ask the same question about reading or writing, and children will say, no, I'm great at reading. And,
right.
Yeah. And I think it's connected to a couple of things. But I think one of the things that we need to think about as teachers is using tasks which do connect to different children's cultural backgrounds, so that they can, and not in a tokenistic way, but in a kind of authentic way. So I think patterns are a really nice way to do that. Because every culture has patterns in them, and, you know, in the within the culture, so we can look at the patterns in a mathematical way.
This is, I'll tell you what, Jodie, it's blowing my mind. I love this, because I'm thinking, so I can only speak from my knowledge of the UK national curriculum for mathematics. But, and like, listeners can write in if I'm talking nonsense here, but nowhere in there is any kind of suggestion that you might want to use different activities that lend themselves better to appeal more to students from different cultural backgrounds and so on and so forth. It's very much, here is a good task that you might want to use. Here is a good representation that you might want to use, but with no kind of sense of cultural diversity in there. Would that be the same for the national curriculum in New Zealand? Would that be perceived as a problem?
Yeah, so it has definitely been previously. Our curriculum and our resources that we had were very, you know, yeah, I guess kind of based on a European, like building blocks, and I don't even know that's European. It's just that kind of, that kind of, yeah. We've just had a new curriculum. Well, it's not officially in action yet, but our new curriculum in New Zealand has been trying to look more in a bicultural sense at the mathematics that comes from Indigenous culture, as well as, and that kind of idea again of weaving it together, which I think is really important. So I think we're making progress, but we're definitely not anywhere close to being there yet.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And can you tell me then about either a specific study or a few studies? I'm really interested in, how you go about designing something to measure the impact that this has and how the students respond. Both the students, I guess, from all different backgrounds, right? The kids what their kind of take on it is and the impact it's had. Can you talk us through a few of these studies, Jodie, if that's okay?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so one of the studies that I undertook was looking at young children, so 6 or 7 year olds, and we had a diagnostic interview with the children. So we had 4 patterning tasks. We used 2 tasks which were kind of decontextualized, just your typical kind of growing patterns and blocks and things like that. We used 2 which had similar patterns, like parallel patterns, but they were in more of a cultural context, and that was and we looked at what did the children do without having any teaching in algebra, basically. Even at that very beginning point, we found the children had a greater capacity to generalize when they had the patterns which were in more of the cultural context. Yeah, so that was really interesting to begin with. And I'm not talking that they were doing great generalizations here, but there was definitely, there was definitely evidence that they had more opportunity with those. And then we did a teaching unit where we taught 10 lessons using tasks which were all set within cultural contexts and all involved the children developing generalizations about how the pattern was growing. And even some of them were very sophisticated for the age of the children. You know, so we had linear growing patterns in there. There was one that was, basically multiply by 8 and add 4 as the pattern. And we used these patterns with the children over, it wasn't typically one lesson because they were quite complex patterns. So we'd use them over 2 lessons, for example. And then we redid the diagnostic interview with the children and showed great gains in what the children were able to do. But probably more importantly to me, during the lessons, we had great evidence of how young children can develop quite sophisticated generalizations. Moving from recursive generalization to developing an explicit generalization, saying things like, oh, but actually that surprised me as well, because they came up with, for this one particular pattern we had, which was using a, it's actually from Cook Island culture, it's a type of quilt pattern that's called a TVIVI, which is hand sewing quilt, and it's based on, the patterns are based on nature, replicating nature. Quite often people think, oh, lots of geometry in it, and I'd looked at it and thought, actually my grandmother did, you know, made these TVIVIs, and I kind of got the idea from looking at her sewing these, and I was looking at it and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. It had this beautiful pattern in which had kind of four leaves in the middle and then eight leaves around the sides, but kind of four parts shooting off it, and it kept growing like that. Yeah, so I'd use that with the children. And what was interesting for me is when I looked at it, all I could see was it had four in the middle and then it kind of went eight, 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 eight. And yeah, but when the children looked at it, they came up with far more creative ways to describe how the pattern was growing than I did. So yeah, that was very interesting. The other work we've been doing in a much more kind of wide scale is we've had a project, we've been using comparative judgment as a tool to look at children's responses, quite a wide scale responses. And for this work, we've designed tasks which we're providing to schools and to teachers to use with growing patterns. And we use a mixture of your kind of typical growing patterns that you'd have in the New Zealand curriculum and New Zealand resources, as well as some of these kind of cultural, you know, growing patterns, but with a cultural orientation. And yeah, we're also tracking how children generalize the patterns and the development, like pre and post as well, using open free response items and then comparative judgment. And we've found huge shifts as well in how the children are able to generalize with these patterns. So yeah, so it's very interesting work. Yeah.
God, this is interesting. So a few questions on this. First, yeah, well, let's do patterns first. I love patterns. Even at a secondary level, I think generally they're underused in terms of getting students to, as you say, generalize, but also, be more confident to talk and to speculate and conjecture, and not to reduce algebra into, you know, collecting like terms and solving equations and so on. Mm-hmm. And I've had a similar experience to you where you'll put a pattern on the board, you know, kind of three terms that maybe is part of a linear sequence or whatever, but it's formed of squares and triangles and so on. And you say to students, can you describe in words how you see this pattern grow? And there's always three or four completely different takes on it. And often as a teacher, you just have one way of seeing this, maybe two at most. But, you know, it's a magic moment for some students when they can describe a way that they see it. And, you know, the rest of us are like, wow, okay, I didn't see that, and so on. And then, of course, you can then link that to the formal algebraic representation later on. But patterns are so powerful, aren't they, Jodie? Such a rich resource for getting students to open up, discuss, but also in that kind of path towards generalization.
Yep, no, I totally agree. And I think, you know, this geometric patterns are really underused. And yeah, there's lots of opportunities if you're looking in primary school for, and even lower secondary as well, to use patterns, but you can also touch on a whole lot of other areas of mathematics, you know, multiplication, representation, as you said, generalizations and justification and explanations. So I think you can kind of use them as multi-purpose tools.
I agree. And I'll tell you what, this is slightly off topic, but we'll just go there anyway. So I love a pattern to introduce like linear sequences. It's really good to start from a pattern and then, you know, to formalize it. But I'll tell you what's always interesting is once kids have got their heads completely round nth term rules, arithmetic sequences and so on, if you then give them like an nth term rule, like, you know, a sequence is 3n take 4 or whatever, and then say, can you draw me three patterns, you know, geometric patterns that would match that sequence, kids can't do it. It seems to be a real struggle to go back the other way. And it always fascinates me that the sequence, the geometry is almost used as a way into the algebra, which is fine. But then to try and then go back the other way, that seems to be a whole other kind of, maybe the kids need to, maybe it's a bit of creativity needs to come into play or something like that. But again, that feels like a really underserved thing to, once you're kind of in inverted commas, kind of algebraically competent, to then kind of use those skills to go back to the pattern. That seems to be something students find difficult. I don't know if you've any experience or anything with that kind of going back the other way at all.
Yeah, and I think we can do with younger children, we can do a bit of preparatory work with that. One of the things that we've looked at doing is we had like a pattern out of dance that we, you know, as I was sharing with you before, which involved kind of slapping your legs twice and then clapping once. And what we did with these young children with that was then we then said, take that and reproduce it using different material.
Nice.
And it was really interesting to see what they did, because some of it, like, and it's exactly what you're saying, even with these young children, some of them got three counters, like two, so they get two counters of one colour and one counter of another colour to kind of represent the slaps and the claps. But then all they did was stack the counters on top of each other.
Right, so
yeah. And we were kind of like, how does that show the pattern? And it was really interesting for us to look at it. And then we had others who kind of like tried to show the pattern like in a physical representation. So they put, you know, kind of two counters out far and one together to represent the clap. So I think, yeah, again, that I think it just shows we don't often think about children coming up with their own patterns.
Yes.
And yeah, and that's a really important thing to think about. But I think a bridge there is asking children to take a pattern and represent it in different ways.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, the whole
use the same structure. But
I mean, we could talk all day about the, like, the whole field of kind of learner generated examples. I think is a kind of a bit of an underserved one. Just generally, it's one thing being able to answer a question, but it's another thing essentially being able to be told an answer and some constraints and come up with your own kind of questions to get there. And it's, yeah, it's something I didn't do enough for about probably 12 or 14 years, but I'm absolutely obsessed with now. It's fascinating. I think what I wanted to ask you as well, just in terms of the kind of research itself, so if we take the students, and I'm using all the wrong phrases here, Jodie, so forgive me for this, but if we take the students whose kind of cultural background matched these kind of activities and patterns that you were doing, how did they fare? Did you test them kind of, was there any formal test of kind of academic progress after it, or a test of how their confidence and the way they talked about their culture changed? Like, what fundamentally changed with those students if we deal with those first?
Yeah, so we have both, in fact. So we've got a lot of evidence in the work that we've done about how children's academic achievement really accelerates. And what's been interesting for me as a researcher is that we're using these kind of cultural tasks intermixed with abstract mathematical tasks, of course, and, you know, decontextualized tasks and different formats. But we've got a lot of evidence that the children's capacity in some of the, we don't have a lot of standardized tests in New Zealand, so it's a bit of a cultural difference, but we do have PATs, which are progressive achievement tests, and they're kind of a standardized scale score. And we've had evidence of the children's achievement moving up quite, you know, dramatically in those types of tests, where we've had schools which are the lowest socioeconomic school in the country level pegging with children who go to one of the highest. You know, so we have this decile system, and decile one's the lowest. And we've got schools where the children are achieving as well as children who are at decile eight. So, yeah, so I think it definitely has benefits for academic progress. But also the other important thing, I think, is this attitude where I was talking about those children who have this kind of deficit idea about their own culture. Yeah. And I've got, conversely, where we've worked with schools for a year or two or 3 years, and we've interviewed the children again, and they say drastically different things. So I had a beautiful quote from a child, a different child, but the one I said before about how he was Tokelauan and it was weird to be do maths because Tokelauans don't do maths. At the same school, 3 years later, we interviewed the children again, and I had a little boy who was probably about eight or nine. And when we asked, how do you feel being Tokelauan in the maths classroom, he talked to us about how he felt really good because maths was an important part of his culture, and his culture was also in maths in school. And then he went on to tell us, you know, my culture's in everything I do at school, and that's just how it should be. So.
Wow. God, that's magic. Yeah. That's absolutely
brilliant. Yeah.
Oh,
it was. But the other, yeah, but the other part that's really been rewarding for myself too is we have a lot of children talking about how they now see mathematics outside of school. And, you know, so in using these tasks in the classroom, the children are now saying, oh, actually, I can see how mathematics is part of my life outside of school, and mathematics is part of who we are and what we do.
Oh, that's really good. This is really good. One more kind of researchy question on this. What happened with the kids who, and again, forgive me for the wrong phrasing here, but whose cultural background did not match these tasks, if that makes sense. So, because what you don't want to happen is they now hate maths and can't do it and so on and so forth. What happened there?
Yeah, so I think what we do is we don't, you know, we're not using solely only these types of tasks. We try and link with different children's culture.
Yeah.
But what we also do is we work with the teachers to open up the task. So, because if you take dance, for example, every cultural group has different forms of dance in it. Yeah. So, for example, when I'm using a task like this with children in the class, I'll usually begin the problem with introducing this, but also getting the children to share what some dances from your own culture, you know, so that they can actually connect themselves, so you're not alienating anybody. And it's the same, I think, with, you know, using kind of cultural artifacts. In fact, we had a beautiful example. A teacher wrote to me who was really excited about this because she had a child who was from Afghanistan. We've had a number of children from Afghanistan coming into New Zealand as refugees. This was a couple of years ago. And you couldn't get a further away place from the Pacific Islands than Afghanistan. And you would think that, you know, how can those match together? Yeah, and she wrote spontaneously to say that she'd been teaching this algebra lesson, and we have in our culture this tapa cloth, which is like a bark cloth which has patterns on it to tell a story. And she wrote and said, I was using this task and we had a quick discussion at the beginning about tapa cloth and what it was and the cultural significance. And this child from Afghanistan got very excited and said, oh, I have something similar in my own culture, and we have, you know, a cloth that tells stories. So yeah, so you can connect across different cultures to these tasks, you know. It's not like I'm not talking about taking a huge part of your mathematics lesson. A couple of minutes discussion about the context of that, and we can open it up to all of the children in the classroom.
It's really nice.
I think, yeah.
Really nice, really nice. This is a bit of a follow-on question, and this will sound like a horrible question, but I don't mean it to at all. So if I think back to some of the biggest mistakes I made as a teacher, it was trying to shoehorn in kind of, in inverted commas, kind of real life applications for some of the maths that I was teaching. And the kids were like, what are you going on about here? And if anything, it had the opposite effect in terms of engagement and motivation. And I see this a lot, this kind of almost kind of like a gimmicky opening to try and give the math some purpose where really it doesn't. So like a classic example here might be, you're about to teach Pythagoras' theorem to some 14-year-olds or whatever, and the way in is to say, oh, imagine, I mean, no one will do this. This is an extreme example, right? But you can imagine someone saying, okay, you're walking along a road, you see a ladder leaning against a wall, and you just would love to work out the length of this ladder. And the kid's like, well, I wouldn't. I have no interest in the length of this. And it, you know, it backfires, right? And that's like a ridiculous version, but you can imagine similar things playing out. Is there a danger that teachers become kind of so obsessed with thinking, okay, I've got to make this appealing to all my different students, that we get this kind of gimmicky shoehorning in of kind of the context, and actually it has the opposite effect in terms of engagement and that we want it to, if that makes sense?
Yeah, and I absolutely understand what you're talking about. I do remember a lesson in my own classroom where I devised a problem which I thought was going to be a great way of looking at, it was with much younger children, year threes, and I thought it would be a great way of looking at combinations up to 20, and I'd made this problem where you had 20 mice in a cage and 2 cages, and they had to go between the cages in a tunnel, and it fell flat. I mean, mainly because the kids were like, oh, but maybe you'll just have mice sitting in the tunnel, not in either cage.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
no, the tunnel is too small to do that. So, yeah. And I absolutely, absolutely acknowledge what you're saying. I think also I have concerns also that teachers that as educators, we can at times take a context and be tokenistic about really addressing it, if that makes sense. And that's another danger where you're just kind of using something cultural for to teach the mathematics and then you just forget about it. And yeah, and that's kind of destructive in itself as well. So I think, yes, we've got to be very mindful of these kinds of things. I think if you know your students well, and this is what, so when I'm talking about the patterns, part of it for us as educators is knowing the children in the classroom and what patterns they would be familiar with, and then integrating those particular patterns rather than taking kind of a generic experience that we're putting onto the children, if that makes sense. Yeah, so I think we can think about shared experiences that we have within the school, but shared experiences outside in the culture. I also always make the note that I'm not at all advocating that this should be how you teach maths every day. I think this is something that I kind of work on a basis of probably, we integrate some of these tasks like this. We also use geometric growing patterns that don't have any kind of cultural connection as well. So it's a balanced approach as opposed to saying everything must be in a context, which I think when you do that, then you fall into something with Pythagoras, because let's be realistic here, you're better just to teach it like it is. I mean, that's the same with the equal sign. I think you could contort yourself to putting that into a context. And in reality, we're better just to say, right, let's look at some number, equations and number sentences and think about the patterns and relationships in those. Yeah. So I think it's about being mindful of when it's appropriate, what exactly is appropriate, and then how you use it as a teacher genuinely to connect with the students, rather than thinking it's something you have to do all the time and, make everything fit within it.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Now, you've talked obviously a lot about the algebra, because it's kind of to your interest, the early algebra you're interested in, and also the kind of bringing in the different cultural backgrounds. If we focus in on the cultural stuff, does that work across other disciplines within maths as well, or does algebra just lend itself particularly well to it?
No, I mean, I think I've got interest in algebra, so that's kind of what I go naturally to. But I, in fact, have a lot of experience in working with teachers in using cultural context right across different areas of mathematics. So in measurement, I mean, I think measurement quite often is it's very easy to see how different cultures use measurement, because we have a whole lot of kind of cultural artifacts and cultural practices which draw on measurement. So geometry is, again, very easy to see geometric properties and the types of, activities that we do in terms of angles and things like that. But also in terms of cultural artifacts again. So in fact, I think algebra has been one where, and I've written journal articles on this, because in fact, I think some of my thing about working in algebra is that was an area where it really wasn't that apparent. For me as a researcher and as a teacher, like you said, I didn't really see very much at all of people looking at the patterns that came from cultural context in New Zealand resources or ministry guidance. So it was probably the opposite, I think.
Yeah.
Where algebra was the one that wasn't kind of, people kind of went, well, no, algebra, you don't really, yeah. Geometry was always the one, as a teacher, geometry was the one, I think, that we really touched on kind of culture, because geometry is easy. That makes sense.
Yes. No, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah.
The one I quite often have difficulty with more, and I probably avoid trying to contextualize too much, is number, especially when you're getting into multiplying big numbers or adding big numbers, because then it becomes very contrived. If you are multiplying, even with, numbers into the thousands, there's not very many contexts where you're really genuinely going to do that. It becomes a very contrived kind of thing. So
it's interesting, and as you say, I think your mice example's a really, really interesting one, where you do you don't want those surface contacts to become distracting and the attention goes there. At some point, you just want to say, look, let's just strip everything else out. Let's just get comfortable with this maths. And we can either use the kind of culture as the way in, or we then come back to it. Or the context as the way in, and then we come back to it on the way out. But sometimes stripping it all out is the way forward. Yeah, that's really
interesting. And I think that's a really nice analogy, because I do that with the patterns, as we've got that kind of cultural pattern, but often I get children to, you know, re-represent that, or think about if you were using numbers to show what is happening with that pattern, that you can do that. And then you can go back again at the end to say, okay, and how does that map and align with what you've worked out and what you've shown?
Yeah, that's nice. That's nice. And I think I've certainly been guilty of this, not doing the coming back to it at the end, I think, you know, and that's kind of going back to what you were saying before with the kind of a bit of tokenism, like let's kind of borrow a bit of this cultural stuff to get us in there and then let's forget about that, do all the maths. But if you don't then revisit it at the end, what was, you know, you can't, you've underserving it, and what was the point of doing it in the first place? Yeah, really, really interesting. I like that. I wonder if, so we'll have thousands of teachers listening to this, and I know that obviously you can only talk from kind of your experience and so on, so no one's expecting you to have advice that's going to work for absolutely everybody. But I wonder if we take the cultural stuff first, if we've got teachers listening to this in the UK, Australia, US, all over the place, who are listening to this like me, thinking, you know what, I've not done as good a job as I should have done with this. I've got students from very diverse backgrounds. And particularly what you said at the start, where some of those students may already think they're bad at maths because of the kind of culture that they come from, or they, you know, what advice would you have for teachers to integrate and make use of students' cultural backgrounds more in lessons without falling into some of the traps that you've also talked about?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I've got one, firstly, because I think often as teachers, it's difficult for us to know about what children do outside of school and genuinely know their lives. That's difficult for us to find out about. I've had a project where we've given children cameras and asked them to take photographs of activities that they do outside of school, which they think are connected to mathematics. And I've been talking to teachers about that being a potential kind of homework activity or mathematical writing activity, where you can, because so many people have smartphones and it's very easily accessible to have children take photographs and then to get them to write a story that goes with that as well, so you can, you know, integrate that in, or mathematical writing. So I think that's one way we can become alert, but that's also got a double positive, because it also can help the children start seeing the mathematics that's around them in their lives as well. I have found when we initially start doing that with children, they have a tendency just to take digits and numbers. So my suggestion with that is, if that's what happens, get the children to share the photographs, because you always get a couple of kids who don't do that. And then once they've shared them, it kind of widens everybody's perspectives. Yeah. I think the other part is, often we have people in our schools, I'm pretty sure you do. You have teaching assistants in your schools in the UK. Yeah, New Zealand, we have teaching, we call them teacher aides. In many countries, we have these people who are often working and are experts really in the community and within the school as well. So I'm always a big advocate for working in a kind of collaborative way, and often the teaching assistants who live within the community, if you as a teacher don't, and have more of the connections, are good people when you're talking about a context that you want to use to ask about even the kind of cultural connection or the significance of this, or because again, I had an example of somebody, a teacher writing a problem where they wanted to do, I think it was fractions and proportions, and they were making it was a recipe, and they just got the proportions so far out that it again failed miserably, because the children were just like, you can never put that much in it. So yeah, whereas I say, you can say, you know, if it's not, I mean, we can look on the internet, that's another resource. I personally, in New Zealand, we've got, like, for Pacific, because I'm Cook Island and I'm working with children from across different Pacific countries, so sometimes there's like local groups. We have a website called CocoNet, which is about all the Pacific Islands, and it has the kind of dances and it has how you make things and things like that. So you can kind of, kind of have that as another example, because often there are internet resources you can use. But going back to my teaching assistant idea, I think that we can really value what teaching assistants, teacher aides bring into schools and the knowledge that they have.
I think I've put a big star next to that, because I think you're 100% right. I've not done that enough. And also, what happens often, these teaching assistants, they'll be able to engage perhaps, you know, the one or two students that they're working with at that moment, because they'll use, as you say, their local knowledge. They've got the knowledge of those students. But if you can tap into that beforehand, then you might be able to share that with all the class, as opposed to just the one or two students that the TA is working with. So I think that's a really, really important point there, Jodie. I love that one. Shifting now to the algebra side of things, because again, I'm fascinated by this. I wonder if you've got any advice for teachers, and perhaps we can maybe separate this, or you can put them together. It's up to you. Teachers teaching primary school, early years, and so on with the early algebra, but also going through to secondary school teachers who are then kind of building on top of that and teaching some more complex algebra. Any advice from them based on your kind of research and studies to help students access it? Because I know so often I'll get kids at secondary school who tell me straight away they hate algebra, can't do algebra, because in their head it's all about X's and Y's and solving things and so on. So any just general thoughts on helping kids feel more successful and accessing algebra a bit better?
Yeah, so I think start early is my first one. Yeah, start early. So 5-year-olds, you can start using equal sign tasks with 5-year-olds and teaching them what the equal sign means in a genuine sense from, you know, 5 years old. I think listen for children making conjectures and generalizations about number properties and operations and the kind of structure that they see in that kind of number side. So as a teacher, we need to become attuned to listening to children making those, and then get all of the children to look at it and see, does it work or does it not work, or when does it work and when does it not work, so that it becomes a natural part of our teaching practice in our classroom. And I think in that way we can demystify algebra as well, because I also think part of the off-putting part is that we don't do enough of that in primary school, and then they come into secondary school and it becomes this big thing, which, yeah. I guess my other part too is, I think as teachers, I have sometimes seen teachers talk about algebra in a negative frame themselves, because I think people go, oh, it's the algebra part of maths. Yeah. And I think we have to be very careful with that when we're teaching, not to center algebra as this really difficult, tricky part of mathematics. Because I think when we do that, then we kind of create this notion that algebra is this really hard subject that nobody can access apart from a certain kind of group of people.
So I think those
are kind of some of the key points, I'd say. And I think with your lower secondary, I think it's kind of double-barreled for me. One is, I think about what are the children bringing in terms of generalizations that they may already have and that they know about and things like that. But I also think we do have to be aware, as you're probably aware coming from secondary school, that we can't assume, say with the equal sign, we can't make the assumption that children do have an understanding of things like the equal sign. And if we assume that they do and just go barreling on in our teaching, then that does create a whole lot of issues.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes we need to just spend a little bit of time going back, even if it's just a warm-up activity, to check those kinds of things with the students and make it clear if they don't have understanding of the equal sign as showing, you know, relationships or, equivalents.
It's really interesting. I'll tell you, kind of building on that, I think my biggest failing of my teaching of algebra over the years has been, we talked about this a little bit earlier, I've often used kind of representations or manipulatives to get kids into the algebra, but then it's all about the kind of formal stuff. But like we said with the cultural stuff, if you can then return to it afterwards, it just helps students really grasp it a lot more. So, you know, a classic example of this is what we talked about with the patterns. You use the patterns to get kids into understanding about sequences, but then once they've got that understanding, let's return to the pattern to see if they can generalize, because generalization is such an important part of mathematics as a whole, but there's a real danger it can be such an abstract, complicated, scary thing. Whereas often the easiest way to generalize is if you've got something physical, whether it be a dance, whether it be a pattern or something like that. And I think I've certainly been guilty of not returning to those manipulatives, returning to those concrete things afterwards, because I think that I'm only using them to get to the formal stuff, but the formal stuff's pointless unless you can then, you know, put it into a context that makes sense. So I think that's where I've gone wrong, not returning to whatever materials I'm using after the formal stuff's been taught, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that the kind of role of physical materials is really important in terms of getting children to justify and kind of prove their ideas and exactly what you're talking about. So I've seen wonderful examples of teachers using arrays with children and getting them to generalize about the commutative property of multiplication and use an array to show that it doesn't matter how large the numbers are, that the product is still going to be the same no matter which direction it's in. Yeah.
Really?
And that's just a really nice way of connecting the generalization of representation and, you know, notation as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've got two more questions I want to ask you. But then again, if there's anything we haven't covered about your research that we can dive into, that's absolutely fantastic. You mentioned very briefly earlier on comparative judgment as a way that you were kind of evaluating students' responses. I'm obsessed with comparative judgment. In this Research in Action series, we've spoke to, I think, Ian Jones, who was researching comparative judgment in mathematics. But I just wondered if you can just touch briefly on how you've used it for kind of evaluating students' responses and your kind of perception of comparative judgment and the role it can kind of play in mathematics assessment. And the reason I ask is it's just certainly in the UK very, very rarely used for maths. It's all about, you know, being used for writing and so on and so forth.
Yep.
Very rarely is it used in maths, and I just think there's a lot of potential there.
I absolutely agree with you. We've been using it at kind of multi-purpose. So we've been using it to assess children's responses to these kind of open-ended or free response tasks. So we might give them a pattern and then ask them to continue the pattern, generalize the pattern, write everything that they can tell us about the pattern. And it's hard to mark that, for example, because you get such a diverse range of responses from the students. So comparative judgment gives us a objective and kind of non-biased way of assessing these children's responses. So we've used it for this wide-scale assessment, and then we've been looking and putting in kind of curriculum levels, best fit curriculum levels against that. But the other part which I'd talk about is using comparative judgment. It just became aware to me, because I do work in professional development, I became aware of the potential, which I think is a really unused potential, of using comparative judgment as a tool for professional development, because it gives you the capacity to look at a whole range of student responses of something that you've taught or has been taught across your school. And you can use that then to think about, from these children's responses, what have I taught really well as a teacher? And what is something I haven't potentially taught that well? And then to think forward about what kinds of tasks you're going to use to address those parts which may not have been taught so well, or, you know, what did you need to focus on a little bit more? But the other part of that too is, I think a lot of teachers I've worked with using comparative judgment, they say that they've got a much better understanding of this kind of trajectory of learning of concepts from looking at children's responses across different year levels, even within the same year level. So I think that's a huge untapped kind of potential area. And it's interesting. I think that's, you know, yeah, the teachers I've worked with using comparative judgment and looking at it in this kind of professional development way, yeah, it's fascinating for us as educators to have this opportunity to look at a whole spread of different responses to a task and the kind of creative ways that children might come up with things, or the insight that we can get into their thinking.
Love that. Never thought to do it in terms of that that use for, yeah, professional development, to give you a sense of how well you've taught something above and beyond just looking at a range of, you know, summative test results and stuff. That's really, really, I love that. I'm going to use that. Love that.
Can I add one more to it? Yeah. And then the other one I think is getting children to look at other responses, peers' responses. Yeah. Which is another really good way of getting the children to think about how you give a good explanation, how you represent your mathematical thinking, how you justify. So I think, again, that's a really nice way. In New Zealand, our assessment system in secondary school is quite strongly linked with children giving explanations, and to get your kind of top marks, you have to be able to give an explanation, you have to be able to represent your thinking and things like that. So there's a whole lot of potential there, because when you, again, when you're a student, a pupil, looking at other pupils' responses to a mathematics thing, it becomes really obvious that, you know, what looks, I think children can see what a good mathematical explanation is just as we can as teachers, and then it provides good models as well. So that was my final one.
Absolutely, we're on board with comparative judgment. Love it, that's brilliant stuff. That and my final question just about your research is, what are you working on at the moment? What's coming next in this area that kind of excites you?
Yeah, so I've put in an application for research funding. I don't know if it will be approved or not yet. That remains to be seen. But yeah, the project that I've got in mind is, again, this kind of weaving together mathematics and Indigenous knowledge systems. So the project that we've proposed is to work in New Zealand, to work in the Cook Islands at a school in the Cook Islands, and Niue, which is another very small Pacific island, and to work with the community and teachers there to develop sets of tasks and kind of ways of teaching which weave together this idea of Indigenous knowledge and mathematics, that makes sense. And then we want to kind of conceptualize what it would look like, for example, for children in the Pacific, mathematical engagement, all of these kind of terms, disposition terms that we've used a lot, but we tend to kind of only think about in terms of one cultural framing. So I'm quite interested in, we use like engagement as a notion, you know, teachers will talk about how engaged the children are in a task. And I'm not necessarily convinced that that's the same across every cultural group. So yeah, so I'm hoping to kind of build a way of looking at engagement from a different cultural framing, or well-being. So a lot of the tools we've had for well-being have been, you know, from one perspective. And I'm interested in this idea of mathematical well-being as well. So, and how can we think about mathematical well-being for a child who comes from a Pacific nation, for example? So yeah, big ideas and a lot to go forward with.
That sounds well. Maybe, hopefully, in a future episode of this series, you can come on and tell us about those, because that sounds absolutely brilliant, that, Jodie. I love it. I love that.
Thank you.
So was there anything that we haven't covered about your current research that you wanted to mention just before I start to move on to reflections?
Yeah, probably. I guess the main part I'd say for me is for us as educators and for teachers to be able to look at every child coming into our class is bringing knowledge and bringing kind of wisdom and experiences into our class. Because I think often as teachers, we think of children in terms of gaps or what they don't know, instead of thinking about what they are bringing. So that's the other part of my research, which I think is really important, is trying to think about how we as teachers, as educators, can look at all the resources that children bring into the classroom.
It's a really nice way of framing it. I love that. That's brilliant. Right. So one reflection, and then I'm going to hand over to you for your big three. So the reflection is, what's an example of something important you've changed your mind about, Jodie?
So probably for me, it's a little bit of a setting, kind of a different setting context, I suppose. In New Zealand, typically our teachers, particularly at primary school and even up into secondary school, aren't given textbooks or curriculum. They're expected to develop their own tasks and develop their own kind of curriculum in each school that you work in. And I thought previously that was really important and a good thing for teachers to be doing. And that's probably something I have changed my mind a little bit about, where I think that, in fact, it's probably better to give more support to teachers in terms of task trajectories and curriculum resources, so that teachers can then spend their planning time on thinking about the mathematics that's embedded within that, or thinking about how you could potentially recontextualize something, rather than having to start from scratch and go upwards. Yeah, so I think that's been something I've changed my mind about quite drastically, because previously I'd always been reluctant to provide resources, and now I've basically started providing resources. Yeah, and I've Yeah, and I've seen very good results in terms of it, because I think as mathematics education researchers, we're spending our whole time working with a mathematics. It's different, a little bit different potentially in the secondary space, but you know, for primary school teachers, often they're having to teach quite a lot of different subjects, and they, you know, you can't have an expectation that you can be a complete expert in every subject. So
yeah, that's been my my kind of journey on this has been similar to you there, Jodie. If you'd have asked me 15-16 years ago, I'd have said no, teachers should be planning every lesson themselves, mm-hmm. making it bespoke to their kids, blah 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 blah. The more schools I visit, the more teachers I work with, the more I think about the complexities of teaching. It's just madness. It's utter madness not to have at least some kind of base level of, you know, quality assured resources that mm-hmm. everyone at least starts mm-hmm. from, and then, as you say, spends their time thinking about how to adapt or get the most out of those for their kids. It's crazy. And in recent years, I'm going even further with this. Like, I think it's madness. I wrote a post about this recently. I think it's madness how in the vast majority of schools I visit, there's no almost kind of predefined way of doing worked examples or supporting kids through independent work or starting lessons, and teachers are just doing essentially what they want, and sometimes it works, but most of the time it doesn't. And the greater benefits there are to either consistency or prescription, whatever you want to label it as. But yeah, we're the same in the UK. It will be you go into two secondary schools, you know, a mile apart from each other, and you'll just see completely different things being delivered because it just seems crazy. But anyway, that's for another conversation. That's good. Right, Jodie, so over to you for your big three. So what would be three websites, blogs, books, whatever you want that you'd recommend listeners check out, and I'll put links to these in the show notes.
Yep, sure. So I have got firstly a website, which I can give you the link for. It's at educationcounts.govt.nz/topics/BES/ambitious mathematics for young Pacific learners.
Nice.
And just to give you a heads up what that resource is, it's actually me teaching a lesson. I don't like to watch it personally. But I have had positive feedback. So it's me teaching a lesson of using the TVIVI, you know, the algebraic pattern, to some year four students.
Amazing.
And it's up on one of our Ministry of Education websites. There's also a number of other really amazing videos on there as well. So that's a great resource to look at.
Oh, amazing. And for listeners who didn't get all the slashes and stuff there, don't worry about that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. That's brilliant. Good one there, Jodie. What about number two?
So number two, I'll just do a little bit of a call out for the organisation, which is called MERGA, M-E-R-G-A, which is the Mathematics Education Research Group of Australasia. So they have a yearly conference, and all of their conference proceedings are available online for anybody to access, open access. And so for me as a teacher, I really liked going to those to look at the resources. I mean, look at them in terms of resources, because they're conference papers, they're 8 pages long, so they're not a long, kind of unwieldy, impossible to access journal article or anything like that. I think that you can have a look at some of the research that's happening in Australia and New Zealand as well, and the kind of Pacific, Asia Pacific region. And
love it. That sounds like a good one. Yeah, that's great.
Yes. Yep. So that's merga.net.au. And then if you look up their publications and conferences, you'll be able to find that. So third one. So two of my colleagues from Australia, Michael Mitchell-Moore and Joanne Mulligan, it's a book, so I'll send you the link for the book. They've had a project which is called PASMAP, which stands for Patterns and Structure Mathematics Awareness Program. And they have some wonderful books for early years, so Foundation Year 1, Year 2, Year 3 kind of age group. And all of these books about introducing children to kind of structure and patterns in the early years. And I think they've got a really lovely way of thinking about how we can do this with young children in a way that develops structural thinking.
Wow. Okay. Geez, not heard of any of those three. So they sound absolutely brilliant. So yeah, for listeners, there'll be links to those in the show notes. Well, Jody, this has been brilliant. This is Colin sent through the list of things that people are going to be talking about, and this one caught my eye straight away because, as I say, it's been certainly something I've not thought about enough, both the algebra side and also the cultural side, and this has given me plenty to think about, and I'm sure that's true of our listeners too. So Jody Hunter, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. It's been great.